system, right? I mean, it's not like you have to go through file cabinets, right?
No, oh, that's about years, yes.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Twenty years.
No, that's what I mean.
Can I just ask a quick question? So an example of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, when I wrote to you the other day and I asked for what the definition of 1240 was, that is something if an average person were looking at the budget, could they tell all the information that you wrote to me? In other words, what you told me that the 1240 codes, what on the main budget, it says superintendent services. Would a person be able to say, okay, so what does that mean? Where's the superintendent's salary? Where and what are all the other breakdowns within that?
It's labeled on there.
Is it labeled on there?
Yeah, the department header is labeled.
Under salaries, yeah. Travel, contracted service, supplies. That's under 1240. This, that's not her salary. That's not her salary.
There's multiple administrators.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
How do you know?
That's why the org chart and the, it's helpful. That's why I do that.
So just let me go back to that. What? I just want to go back to this. So under 1240-1020-00, it says salaries, chief school administrator subtotal. And the subtotal is 538-271. But that's not the superintendent's salary.
No, it's
not salary. It's
that. Yeah.
Yeah, so right. So it's
that,
like
the whole code is superintendent's office.
Right, but where is it in the budget that it says what the superintendent is paid or what the executive director is paid? We have to go to the New York State to see that? Is that?
Not necessarily.
I'm just saying, in terms of transparency and trying,
yeah.
For me, who is not a budget person, I look at that and I say, oh, well, does that mean that's how much the superintendent makes? Or do I have to go further?
Yeah, no, in some cases.
And why isn't it broken out? That's kind of what I'm saying, and I think it's, I don't know, it's represented in other parts of the budget.
I think that one is actually.
Her salary.
1240.
Yeah, it's in here, salaries. But you have everything mushed together. I don't know, does anybody else understand what I'm saying? Does it not make sense?
Well, I mean, it will be, we have, do you want everyone's individual salary?
No, I'm just saying, how would a person understand what, I'm not saying what I want from you, I'm questioning, how would a person understand what the salary of the given superintendent is, or of the deputy superintendent, or the I can't find that in here. I have to go to New York State to find that.
So I think it's broken out on the budget.
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah,
no,
not instructional and instructional.
Where is that?
So this is 1240 superintendent salary, then non-instructional. So this is instructional, it's non-instructional.
So whose salary is that?
Yeah.
That's the question. Superintendent salary, and then where are the benefits? They're in another place, and then,
We have to go with that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm just trying to understand. I'm just trying to understand it.
So too, every year at budget time, things that we have to put together in a binder with the school report card and with the supplemental report from the state, all that kind of stuff. Property is administrative salary disclosure, and that's a piece of it. And
okay.
All the administrative salaries making over a certain amount are included.
And where is that found?
We send that out with all our budget data that we put on our website, and that goes, we put a binder together that goes to each school and the library.
Okay.
And
great.
That's one of the pieces of information.
Okay. Sorry I interrupted
David
your
thing. David can probably memorize
thing.
It all.
I had one question. Looking through, there's the fund balance spreadsheet that was sent out. And so, again, completely not even looking at the column C and D with 2021, 2020, because, of course, that's not normal school years. But just looking at 2016 to 2019, the funds and the reserves went down a pretty considerable amount from almost 27 million, is it, to just under 22 million. And just curious, you know, why we saw that
sure.
steady decline and without trying to keep it more level, right?
Sure.
And again, I'm not trying to
That's okay.
work backwards, right? I'm the type of person,
yeah.
let's just make going forward better, but I think that helps
right.
to understand
what
that.
Was the reason?
Can
yeah.
I give you like a 5-minute history? Of
no, we need a 5-hour history.
Okay, good. Even better. Even
I'm kidding.
Better.
I'm kidding.
Even better. Okay. No, seriously, though. I want to go back a little bit in history just so to because I think it's important that you know how we got to where we are. All right. So in the early 2000s, superintendent left and nationwide search was done. Superintendent from Ohio was brought in, right? Among other things that made his tenure here a disaster, he thought it was his right to use a district credit card in for his personal expenses. All right, so that turned out to be a disaster. He left in 04, actually had to pay back about $54,000 to the district. All right, so a retired, say that again?
So that was the full amount?
That's how much he had, yes, that's nothing. How much, it was a forensic audit was done.
Yep.
It was determined that it was, that's how much and he charged to a district credit card that was not district related expenses
right.
Plus time he took off as like not vacation days but like I'm going to a conference and it turned out well there was no conference
right.
So
he
had
was
to
really
pay back
going on vacation
his pay for those days so it came out to about $54,000 so he was gone and he stayed here I think through the end of the 03-04 school year. So then a retired superintendent was brought in, the business official was gone too. A retired superintendent was brought in, and a retired school business official who had actually retired from Three Village years earlier were brought in. And in the, I think it was the 06-07 school year, the total fund balance, reserved, everything, total, was about $3.1 million, right? So in 2007, the superintendent that was here made Cheryl an assistant superintendent, and the business official, the retired business official who I had known from way back, talked me into coming here. I started here in 07, same time Cheryl became an assistant superintendent. We still had a retired superintendent my first 4 years in the district and Cheryl's first 4 years as an assistant superintendent here, we had a different superintendent every year. All right. So that's no way to move forward. Finally, in year five, the superintendent that was here in year four stayed a second year, but even he was a retiree, he was a good guy, but he was a retiree also, you know, it's, you know, keep the ship afloat, not necessarily let's move forward. So then in 2000, during that time is when Gary came in. And then in 2012, the board made Cheryl superintendent. One of the first things Cheryl did as superintendent was she convinced Kevin, who had been a teacher and a chairperson here previously, convinced Kevin to come back to the, take a cut in pay and come back to the district as assistant superintendent. So that was 10 years ago. All right, so then, so 2008, there was the economic disaster that happened, right? So for a couple of years, state aid was cut, but there was federal money, similar to the federal money that was paid out last year. It was called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, I think it was called. So there was a lot of federal money coming in to make up for the shortage in state aid. So, okay, so for a couple of years, it was okay. And then when the federal money stopped, then the state didn't have the money. So what the state did is they put in a new category of state aid. First they called it deficit reduction assessment, then changed the name to gap elimination adjustment. And that was a negative number that every district got to take aid away. They would go through all the formulas and say, okay, Three Village, your aid is going to be $40 million next year. But we're going to put a minus $5 million in gap elimination adjustment. We're only going to give you $35. So that gap elimination adjustment lasted for 6 years, and Three Village lost over $32 million in state aid over those 6 years. During that time, also the tax cap went into place, so we couldn't even make up the money that we were losing in state aid by increasing taxes because of the tax cap. So we wound up cutting, it was over 100 teaching positions, right? And when I say teaching positions, it was over 100 teaching positions. There was also administrators and custodians and clericals and teacher aides and monitors and teaching assistants all across the board, right? But the big thing, well, first of all, the big dollars and really what especially parents with kids in school are most concerned about is instructional staff, teachers. Well, it was over 100 teaching positions had to get cut over a two-year period, all right? So then during the 15-16 school year is when the gap elimination adjustment, it didn't completely end that year, but it mostly ended, and then the following year was gone. So that was a big increase in our state aid, right? And the funny thing is, if you were to go back and read about the, you know, all of the what the state assembly and state senate and the governor was saying at the time was that they were delivering record amounts of aid to schools and they were patting themselves on the back about with the big increase, but all they did was stop taking money away from us. So if every day Gary took $20 from me, and then one day he said, I'm not going to take $20 from you. And it's like he gave me $20. Well, you didn't give me anything. Just because you didn't take my $20 away doesn't mean you gave me anything. But anyway, that's a different story. So during the 15-16 year, we got a lot more state aid. And also, we had done a bond in 2014. And the way building aid comes in on capital projects, once the capital project is finished, we submit a final cost report. If we get that in by June 15th of a year, we'll get state aid, building aid for that year that we're in. So we don't want to assume, especially when we're doing big construction projects, like I wouldn't, if we were doing big construction, if we were in the middle of a bond now, say, well, we'll probably be done next year, so let's assume we're going to get the building aid next year and go with our budget that way. We can't do that. But in that case, in the 15-16 year, we did get most of those projects done. We got the final cost report sent in, and it started generating building aid in that 15-16 year. So we had a big increase in state aid in 15-16 compared to the previous year because of elimination of gap the gap elimination adjustment went away, and we started getting building aid on our big $56 million bond project. So with that big influx of state aid that year that we really didn't budget for because we weren't sure we could count on it, what we did is we put that money into reserves. That's why you see from June of 15 to June of 16, total fund balance went up by almost $10 million. Right. That's why it was like it wasn't like we had so much built into the budget and it was like, wow, we have $10 million left over. It was so much more came in state aid that year. That's why there was a big increase in fund balance going into for the year end of June 30th of 16. And then what we did is in the few years after that, we started using that money to restore, and we couldn't do it through taxes because of the tax cap. We started restoring all those positions, or most of them, that we had cut, those 100-something-odd teaching positions that we had cut back in, I think it was 12, 13, 14. We started restoring those. So So yes, we got one big influx of fund balance of almost $10 million, and then we've been using that over the next few years to restore all those programs and services that we had cut.
And add STEM.
We added STEM, we put in the pre-K program, we started adding those things back that we had cut, so some years earlier. And then, of course, COVID hit, and then we spent so much more in fund balance reserves last year. So that's what gets us to where we are now. Well, part of that plan is also with enrollment had been declining, right? So knowing that staff cuts because of decline in enrollment. Now, we're not cutting programs, increased class size, not that kind of cuts. But because of declining enrollment, it lags behind. You know, we go down number of kids. You know, we say K to 12, we go down, you know, whatever, 180 kids, all right? But divided over 13 grades, over 8 schools, you know, that class lost one kid, that class lost one kid, that class lost one kid. It doesn't mean we cut teaching staff. But that happens a few years in a row, a few years in a row, a few years in a row. Next thing you know, well, we can go down a few teachers. Just like we're talking now, next year, we can go down a few teachers. We're not cutting electives. We're not increasing class size, maybe collapsing some of those electives that have, you know, whatever, 10 or whatever kids in them. Two classes with 9 kids, we make one class that has 18, right? Still not a, still running the elective, but we can start to cut some teaching staff. So that was part of that plan, is knowing that, well, over the next few years, we'll be able to start reducing some teaching staff. And also, we know coming up in a few years, we're going to have a lot of teacher retirements just because of, you know, their life cycle as a teacher. I don't remember if I mentioned it at the last meeting, but of our, you know, 500 and whatever it is, 80-something teachers, 54.5% of them are at, we have 30 steps in the teacher contract, 54.5% of them are at step 25 or higher. So we have a lot of teachers that are going to be retiring starting, well, we have a number retiring this year, but over the next few years. And that's going to free up a lot of money in the budget. Even if we were to replace every single one of them, we save a lot of money on a retiring teacher, but when we hire a new teacher. So all those things kind of combined is what, if not for COVID, we would have been able to get us through to that point where we could keep programs in place and not like, oh, shit, we ran out of money. Right.
So when I calculate that, it's probably about $50,000 in at least salary and then benefits that the district will not be spending. Where does that money go?
Well, that's where fund balance comes from, that kind of thing. So now in that case, well, I don't want to talk about that case specifically because that, you know, we're talking about a person. But to your point, though, those kind of things, that's where our fund balance comes from. So in this coming up year's budget, because of what we have to pay back because of COVID, we'll have a line item in there, planned fund balance with $400,000, right? Because that's the minimum we have to pay back. So that we have to build into the budget. Other than that, those kind of things. Oh, there's money left over in that code. We didn't need to spend all that money in that code. Well, you add those things up, and now ultimately over time, that's where fund balance comes from. In the old days, right? Schools everywhere, and some still do it, but schools everywhere, you would just have enough in every one of those budget codes to take care of anything that might come up during the year, right? So you want, I mean, of course, the dollars years ago were a lot smaller, but in today's dollars, oh, so if we wind up with $5 or $10 million left over in the budget at the end of the year, great, just goes into fund balance. But it's not that way anymore. There's a lot more, I mean, there's a perfect example of the scrutiny on it, and it's good. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, but we can't have so much padded into our budget every year to have that much left over. We just can't. I mean, you know, and you're a perfect example of, you know, of no, that's not the way to do it anymore. And there are some districts that still do that way. They have millions of dollars left over at the end of every year, and it just goes right into fund balance. But so back to your question, Ariana, that money, yeah, that goes in, that will go into fund balance. Or if there's something else that, you know, there's always, now remember, Three Village, one thing different, every district does this to somewhat, but one thing about Three Village, too, is we've always been a district of something comes up during a year, if we can do it, we'll do it. Where we generally try to stay away from telling our parents, sorry, we can't do that, we didn't budget for it. Sorry, we can't do that, we didn't budget for it. A lot of parents that we've had that have moved into the district over the time, that's not what they want to hear. They pay a lot of money in taxes, and they don't want to hear, sorry, we can't do that, we didn't budget for it. So, like it or not, that's just kind of been the way it's been here. It could be, possibly, yeah, possibly, yeah.
We looked at the reserves that we have now.
Yeah.
The $5 million that we took out of the benefits, we need to pay that back.
So technically, what we have to pay back is $2 million.
Which we took from the audit.
Took from the reserve for retirement coverage. That's what we technically borrowed from reserves for COVID. Right now, we spent more than that on COVID. We also used $3 million more of fund balance, but we used it to pay the employees' retirement system bill last year. So while we technically don't have to repay that, we would like to replenish that. Yes. So there's two. I'm not trying to, you know, put a twist on it. We have to pay back $2 million, and we have to pay that back in no more than 5 years. Right. And at least 20% per year. So that's where the $400,000 comes from.
What were the other lines? We got unrestricted investment. We had the employee retirement and benefits.
Right.
Is there a recommended amount to retirement?
Not really. You know, the unreserved, that can be 4%. Forever it was 2% was the most that school districts could have. And then some years ago, I don't know, remember now, 15 years ago maybe, I don't remember when it was. It went up to 3% and then 4%. So, I mean, I would prefer we have 4% in there.
Yeah, I mean, because we got a report from all the Long Island schools, and you're probably one of three.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know what? I've been saying that
right?
Since I've been here. You know,
are
people have said.
Are the reserves a line item in the budget, or will they be?
Not, well, this coming up year it will be.
Okay.
That 400,000. Yes, planned fund balance. This is probably what I'll call it. Or so I forget what I'll call it. I'll call it something.
So there might still be surplus, but you want to guarantee at least.
That one, that 400,000, we have to put in.
Right.
Right. So, and I've been saying that since I've been here, because people have said, well, Three Village, you know, you have so much money and so much money. So I was like, no, we don't. And I would say, look. And, oh, you know, just indulge me for a second. No, but there's also, I mean, so for instance, you as a taxpayer, if we have $220 million budgeted this year, right, and you pay your share of that, right, and then we wind up with only spent $215 million, and we take that $5 million, and instead of saying, well, we can use some of it to lower next year's taxes, we say, well, we're just going to stick that in fund balance, all right? Now, maybe this year you'd be okay with it because of what we took out last year. But if we do it again next year, and the year after, and the year after, and the year after, you might say, well, wait a second. Why am I paying all that tax if you're not spending the money on the kids? Why do we have to spend so much?
There's got to be a balance.
Sure there does.
There's
absolutely.
Got to be a balance, and
yeah.
And I don't think that you achieve that balance by being not having that reserve.
Well, I think we were in a much better shape before COVID.
I agree with Jeff. Completely.
I agree with him, but what I'm saying is I have a hard time understanding that if you have an account that should be in a certain
Oh, no, no, I think prior to COVID, we were in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
So it's all because of COVID?
Well.
I think a big contributing.
I think what I'm hearing, though, is I'm hearing that this is, I feel like you're still, like, all this stuff, you're still cleaning up from all these other things that happened to you, but somewhere along the line,
Well, there's always more to be done.
Right.
Yeah.
So what I'm interested in is why isn't this a priority? And I know you used the example last time of somebody from another district had all these millions of dollars and you said he was crazy for that, but I don't agree with him having millions and millions of dollars because the money should be going.
Right. Yeah.
Schools. But at the same point, there has to be somewhere in there where somebody has to say, this is not good. This is not good for our district to be that cash poor.
Well, I think I would say prior to COVID, though, we weren't cash poor. You know, part of me says, too, like, and not that I pretend like I know better than anyone. That's what I'm saying. But I've been doing school business for 31 years, right? There is not a single school business official on Long Island, except for a couple of retirees that are still hanging around working as interims, that's been doing this job longer than me, right? That doesn't mean I know more than them. I don't mean it that way, but I've seen more. And I've seen districts who have tons and tons and tons of money in reserves. And I've seen some, I mean, Sachem, not that many years ago, they had $14,000 in reserves.
Right.
That's all they had.
I didn't even think they could,
you know, that was, that's
pay, right?
Disgraceful. So for us to have, you know, we had over $20 million in our fund balance on a, you know, little over $200 million budget. I don't know. I think that's pretty good. I mean, could it be higher? Sure, it could. But also, aside from something like COVID, and when COVID hit, and people were saying to us, you know, now, you know, coming up on 2 years ago, is, well, if, and I agree with this, if we're not going to spend the money now to keep our kids in school after COVID hit, if we're not going to use the reserves then, what do we even have it for? And I would be hard-pressed to answer that if we just said, well, we're not taking money from reserves to keep kids in school. Well, it depends on exactly how, you know, but
it depends on what COVID would look like.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
A lot of information was unknown in terms of having a remote option for students, everything.
Yes, we could, because I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head. But a big chunk of what we spent the money on was things like all the Chromebooks and the IT infrastructure to be able to support that, so that we have now in place. But most of the money was spent on additional instructional staff.
So can I ask you about that? Because what of that money that you use the smart school for? We actually went through your last four submissions. Of all the Chromebooks you got, thousands of them.
Uh-huh.
So how much had to be spent there really for COVID on Chromebooks?
I don't remember the number off the top of my head.
Number.
Now, when I say spent on COVID, now there's a couple of different things. There's spent on COVID, no matter where the money came from, right? Which could include smart schools, right? It was an expense, because one thing we had to keep track of was, well, what are we spending on COVID? Not just then, so there's that. There's total that we wouldn't have spent if not for COVID. Then there's, well, how much did we have to pull out of reserves for it? Because remember, even in the year, last year, there was money that was in the budget, right, that was already in the budget that we didn't have to spend because we weren't doing some things. You know, nobody went on conferences or anything like that. So money that we had originally had budgeted for those kind of things. Since we didn't need it for that, we were able to spend that money on COVID-related expenses. So I don't want you to think I'm changing my story around. We spent somewhere around $7 million on COVID, right? On COVID-related expenses that If it weren't for COVID, we would not have spent that $7 million. And that would include some Chromebooks and lots of other things. And then there's how much did we have to take from reserves, right? And then, as I said before, we took about the $5 million, but we only have to technically pay back $2 million of it. So I don't want you to think I'm changing my story around when I use different numbers. So even if it's money from smart schools, if we bought the Chromebooks for COVID, then we're calling it a COVID-related expense. So, by the way, just to get back on my soapbox for a second, when we talk about, like, one of the things that's in our budget that we've spent money on is our buildings. Now, I could tell you when I just use for what I started here, which was in 07, the buildings were awful. They look great from a distance, but you got up close and they were awful. And I give you an example. We had our tennis teams at Ward Memorial High School could not use the tennis courts there. They were condemned. They had to go to the World Gym to practice and Stony Brook University to play their matches. That's how bad they were. We had indoor air quality issues at a number of our buildings. They were awful. And since then, we've put about $200 million into our buildings to get them to where they are now. And they're still not perfect. There's always work that needs to be done.
We're really proud.
We've done a lot on that. Not perfect. There's always still more that needs to be done. Say that again.
But isn't that a reason to start consolidating the buildings if they're so expensive to run? Wouldn't it make sense to start consolidating?
We talked about the old administration building, the Mestrac building. Mm. Have we ever looked at that?
Oh, yeah, we tried renting that. We thought that.
Yes, I think we did.
Yeah, and we looked at selling it too. The only problem with, not, I wouldn't say problem, maybe not a great idea to sell it, is. It's the land, the property itself is connected with Murphy Junior High School. So if we sell that 5 acres, then it's gone forever and ever. And if we could get, I don't know, $1 million for it, all right, and then we have to spread that, that $1 million is not a lot of money, I'm not saying that, but we have to spread, in a case like that, we'd have to spread that money out over 10 years as a revenue in our budget. And you, as a taxpayer, you're not going to see much from our tax levy going down by $100,000 a year for 10 years. You individually, you're not going to really see much out of it. And then that 5 acres in the building is gone forever. So that was part of, and really, hardly anyone was interested in it.
I mean, at one point, there was a doctor's office that was interested, but they quickly fell out.
Yeah.
So there was no sustained interest.
Yeah.
She also looked at putting the academy.
Right. Yeah, because that building was built as an administration building. So it was not built to conform with code for a school building.
So we still maintain that building, but somebody's using it, but they don't pay rent?
Well, that's for us, though, the teacher center. That's a grant that we get from the state.
Right, and security.
And we base our security out of there. And also, the BOCES non-public school textbook distribution.
Do we own the holding outright?
Yes.
Okay. Do we receive revenue?
No.
Why are we not receiving any money? We're just using it for ourselves for security.
Right. The Mestrac.
Well, I think the question somebody had asked was that they noticed that Mestrac, other people from outside of our district come here for courses.
Mm-hmm.
So other people come here and they pay money to take classes there, but
well, the money goes into the Mestrac grant, which runs the teacher center. But the grant is through us. We're the host district of it. So, and our teachers are the ones who get the most benefit out of it.
So is that grant money showing
any
place that
you're not? No, grant money is not in the general fund. It's in the special aid fund.
Way to try and make some money. I'm not sure I understand why you have held on to it.
Yeah, I think our teachers value the teacher center being here. So it's a, I mean, that's a definite benefit to our teaching staff to have the professional development program here.
There's no other buildings in all of the district, there's no empty spaces in any of the buildings that could house that.
Right, because I'm just trying to think about how much space would you need if you were to move into a few classrooms within a school?
Especially with enrollment.
Would that be a big savings? I guess that's what we're getting at. And honestly, I don't believe it. So about the personal interested buyer. Because I am concerned if it's sold, what it would get sold to? Because I'm telling you right now, I'm worried it's going to be a vape shop.
Christine, what did you say?
I'm worried it'll be a vape shop.
Okay.
You know, that's kind of like, everything's turning into a vape shop.
I don't know.
If you sell property,
there are vape shops in the community.
At first, I thought you said a bake shop.
That's what I thought.
I was going to say, my wife would get mad if it was a bakery opened up next to the office.
We did.
I don't remember how it's zoned. Because the property is also, it's the same property as Murphy Junior High School. You know, they connect.
I have one other quick question about that. Isn't MESTRAC an item in the budget that we pay for? I mean, I know we're not showing any of the revenue coming in, but are we paying salaries for people that were there? Are we paying into MESTRAC?
It goes through, not through the budget. That goes through the special aid fund. The money comes from the state. We process the paycheck for the people that work there.
But those don't show up on our budget at all anywhere?
I don't think so.
No benefits or anything like that?
No, we don't pay benefits to them, no.
That's why I'm asking, because I thought it was in
there. It could be that we might pay for our teachers to attend professional development programs. Yeah, I don't know. Let me check on that.
Because it would be odd if there was money going out. It's technically a grant, but there's nothing coming in, but we're spending money on it. Because then we'll comp us whatever we were going to pay you, and we'll exchange that for the use of the building.
Yep, I gotcha.
I mean, we still have to pay for electric, heat, and all these things. So,
right.
Well, but it might also make sense if they took care of that, if they were charging our district and other districts for the services.
Right.
Or maybe ask for a little bit more for the grant. Does that come from the state or is that federal?
Yeah.
And that's
that. Yeah. No, I gotcha.
And
yeah.
It's administrated through us, but how many other districts participate?
I think a pretty good amount. Yeah.
And do each one of them have to apply for that and it all gets
No. They don't get grants for it. No. Other districts would send teachers to programs there that they would pay for.
They're paying into our district. Right?
They would pay in. Well, it goes through the special aid fund. That's a revenue. That's a revenue that MESTRAC has. Again, not through the budget. It goes through our special aid fund to help fund to run the whole teacher center.
So, do our teachers then pay money to attend the courses there?
I would imagine so.
Were paid through that grant. Right now, I believe even through Title made a great difference. So that was added. Our program is a little bit unique to some of the other programs in other districts, and actually has been touted as being one of the better programs in terms of teacher mentorship induction. When you look at many of other school districts in terms of teacher attrition and being able to keep our teachers on staff and not have as many teachers leaving, we do extraordinarily well. And it's because of all of the support system that's put into place. I think that is the most invaluable program.
So I honestly don't disagree with the idea of having mentors, and I know a lot of districts do it as a stipend where somebody get, you know, and they have that relationship. But just looking at the amount of teachers we've hired in the past couple of years, I just don't understand how these three full-time people could be working. And some of the things you mentioned about helping people on tips, providing professional development, those sound like things that maybe like an assistant principal, which we have in every school, could also be doing.
Well, I have to say it's very different in the way that our APPR is structured. It's structured in such a way that it's collegial, so that it doesn't become an issue of the person who is supervising the person is now working on the tip with that individual. There is a role for somebody who's an administrator to play a part in that, but it also is to give collegial and peer support to that person, so as they're going through this process, that it's not a critical, it's not critical.
But do you have a ratio? Because if a few years ago we had 577 teachers, we went down to 571, now we're at 570. Who are they helping, and do you have that many teachers here on TIPS?
No, we don't have that many teachers here on TIPS, but we've hired many new teachers, and those teachers are receiving that level of support. They receive a great deal of support in our district.
So how many of those teachers are participating, or how many do they service, those three mentors?
This year alone, we have about 25 teachers, but not just new teachers. You have to remember also they also deal with the teachers on leave that a leave replacement comes in and handles. I've been in six different districts between Connecticut and New York City and Long Island. Every district has a different configuration for this. There is a mentoring certificate requirement for certification that every district is required to do. And Rihanna, you are correct in that some districts have assistant principals doing that, but that would take an assistant principal out of their...
I'm not saying for mentor. For mentoring is always a teacher. Teacher mentors a teacher. But I'm saying that when you're having somebody who's, you know, helping with, you know, facilitating professional development, with lesson plan, like all those things are things that, you know, we have small schools in elementary with assistant principals. Other districts have gotten rid of their assistant principals. So...
Well, that's a matter of debate with why some districts do that elimination of assistant principals. There are recommendations that come from the New York State School Administrators Association about school size and what we would do. If we attempted to eliminate assistant principals, as Cheryl just pointed out, that would also have an impact on our APPR, which is a requirement as well. We would have to – who's going to go in and do all the observations of all those? Our teachers are observed, tenured teachers, twice, an unannounced and announced observation. New teachers, untenured teachers, up to their fourth year of tenure, have to observe three times, two announced and one unannounced observation, plus a mid-year evaluation and an end-of-year evaluation. So you can do all that. If one principal can do that, we would probably be peeling them off the floor. Having been in a building in a district where I had only two assistant principals in doing that when that first started, it is very complex. The mentors here work closely with my office. We provide the professional development. We do grade level meetings as well, twice a year with the entire elementary level, going through every single grade level. And, you know, it's one of those things you could look at and say, is there too many there? You know, we're given our current size. Given our size of our special education department, why do we have one for just that department? Because it's a unique department. You know, a general education teacher mentoring a special education teacher without having that experience sometimes can be disjointed, and they might not have the ability to mentor them appropriately. We have one for elementary primarily, one for secondary primarily. That's where they really work in those realms. And it's not just dealing with only the new teachers coming along first year. They're also there throughout the years. Even when we've had teachers, sadly, and you know, through HR, we can tell you if they've gone through EAP situations or have to have counseling situations. You know, these are human beings we're talking about. They're not, you know, robots that go in and out of a classroom. They've had, unfortunately, in the past year and a half with COVID, we've had a lot of social emotional issues among staff as well as students. You know, and this is not.
Is that what you were going to
physical and emotional. That program started with Debbie Rutkowski 3 years ago, and you probably read about it in Newsday. It was probably one of its only kind. Most corporations had that kind of a program. We were very unique to be able to start that here. So Robin Weinstein is the current person. She also has a background in social work, and she provides different kinds of programming and support to the staff.
She goes district around the district.
She does go around the district, but the wellness, Wellville is actually set up at Orton Wellville High School.
Right, yeah, so
yeah. But I think with the, in terms of teacher induction, we feel that one of the most important things that we can do here is hire somebody well and then give them the support to be successful. And we don't want to just put our teachers in a classroom and say, okay, well, we'll get to you when we can. And so the mentors working with our, especially our newer teachers, or people who are even new to Three Village, it's a different culture when you come from district to district, giving them that support has been immeasurable in the success that they've had. So I would not want to see us looking at the mentor program as something.
No, we just need clarification because nobody ever heard of it.
Right.
And
we appreciate that. But it has been looked at by the state and considered one of the better programs in the state.
Just generally, mentoring is just done as part of a job. I mean, most jobs, there are people get mentored, but they are just people that are doing a job. It's unusual to turn mentoring into a profession in itself.
I think these are all master teachers, so I don't want to say that. They are master teachers. All three of these individuals themselves have immeasurable experience in the classroom. So when they're seeing a lesson and they're helping somebody with regard to a lesson, they're able to model for that individual and help them to be a better teacher in the classroom. And that's what we want. We want our teachers to be the best that they can be.
Are they also performing quality control? Are they saying, well, this teacher is not going to make it?
Okay, yes, yes. Actually, they will say that to us. Mm-hmm. They will have conversation and say, we've been working with a certain teacher. We realize they're having some difficulty. We try to resolve that difficulty. They'll talk to us about interventions they think they can employ. And there have been times when they've spoken to Kevin, they've spoken to me, spoken to Gary, and said, we've done A, B, C, D, and E. It's not going to work. And we think that either you have to cut this person loose or say, you know, maybe this isn't the right fit for you in Three Village. And they have been extraordinarily helpful to us in identifying that along with the administrator. Because sometimes the administrator will see something, they'll ask the mentor to come into the classroom and also take a look at some of what they're seeing. And sometimes the mentors can provide that level of support and make suggestions that are extremely helpful in getting that teacher back on track. And that's also for our veteran teachers who are struggling as parents.
Yeah, and I think the teacher mentor program is mandated now by the state. So you
there
have to, you
mandate,
have to have.
But how we have it isn't necessarily parent mandated.
Right, yeah, we
but
read
we
up on that.
But we think that our program is supreme. And again, it's about, is it an optimal program? I would say absolutely. Compared to others, definitely optimal.
But I mean, we would also, from a budget standpoint, it's a $500,000 program.
Yes, some of it does come, as I said, from the grant.
Majority of it is.
The majority does not.
Yeah.
The majority does not. But again, we have to weigh, you know, what is important to us. And again, the importance of having the best teachers in the classroom supported and being successful is critical to our students' education.
But it's $500,000 for 25 teachers.
Well, but it's not just 25 teachers. Those are the new teachers. It's not all of the teachers that they work with. And they do work on grade level meetings with the teachers. They do a lot of every single day. They're in the buildings every single day. They are working with teachers. So they are not here They have an office here, but they're infrequently here. They are definitely boots on the ground.
And what about the instructional consultants that are in the schools?
Okay, so the instructional consultants are work with the, they do a lot of work with special education in terms of the sub-CSE meetings that are taking place in the building. They provide a level of support to all of the teachers that are special education in the building. They run a lot of the, they run the IST meetings in the building. They have a lot of responsibility in looking at data for special education students and providing interventions and recommending interventions.
Didn't we hire the 504 chair to do some of that stuff?
Some of the, she does the 504, but that isn't necessarily the sub, she's not doing the sub-CSE meetings. She's definitely not doing this. She's doing 504 meetings, which, as you know, are different.
Okay.
We have a very large special education population here, and I having worked in special ed for a long time, I can tell you that it is a very dynamic office with a lot of students and a lot of issues, and the staff that we have are highly trained to do their job.
So I have another question about saving money. So one concern is that, well, everybody's comfortable paying high salaries for teaching staff, right? Even above market rates. There's a sense that maybe we're paying above market rates on non-teaching staff as well. So here I've got the chart for the, what it seems to be the IT basically. So the executive director, this is back in 2020 because this is where we get the numbers from. So they're earning 210K. So the dean of the libraries at Stony Brook, he earns 230, right? So I'm talking about the executive director of instructional technology in 2020. The dean of the library, the dean of libraries at Stony Brook is running multiple really large libraries. It's a very complex task because everything's become digital, right? He has two assistant deans. They're both earning less than the two people that are below this, below the person earning 210. So what I'm trying to understand is, how do you fill these positions? Do you go out when a position like this is, do you do a national or a state search? Are you looking for the best person for the lowest price here?
It's a difficult question to answer. So when we are looking, if you're talking the person underneath the executive director for instructional technology, because right now we don't have an executive director.
Sure.
So you're saying last year when we were looking for somebody who would be in that role? Sure. So I'm just trying to understand the question. So right now, we do not have an executive director of instructional technology, right? You're talking about 2020. Okay. So when we advertise, we will advertise in the New York Times, we advertise on OLAS, we advertise by word of mouth. Sometimes we call universities to ask if they have any individuals, other school districts that might be interested in applying. We are always looking for the top quality candidate for the position, of course. That is the ultimate goal. With regard to salary, because it's collective bargaining under the Three Village Village Administrators Association, which is TVSAA, we try to fit the salary in we don't want to operate where somebody who's, let's say, an executive director is making less than somebody who's a lower-level position. So we're looking at all of the positions, the years of experience that the individual brings, and trying to fit it into a matrix.
So
Well, no, I don't think we're doing that, but we aren't trying to. What I'm basically saying is that we wouldn't be paying somebody more than we would be paying somebody who is at the highest level. That person would be being paid less.
Yeah, it's not, well, okay, here's what executive directors make, so if we hire a new one, they have to get that. No, make sure it's below that.
Right. Always. Because if we create a new executive director, we are, and let's say we'll take Don Mason, who's been doing the executive director job now for at least 5 years. So Don Mason, we would never hire an executive director and say, okay, Don makes this, so we're going to put this person at that same level. In fact, that person would be below Don. We would want that person below Don because that would make no sense to try and negotiate. Well, also, if you consider, and Jeff just used that as an example, when Kevin came here, Kevin took a cut in salary to come here. So that is not always true. In fact, people do come to Three Village.
Well, I was in a lower position, by the way. I was a high school principal in Roslyn for 7 years. After the scandal, I wasn't in the scandal.
Just to make sure I went out. So, so people do, in this district, come here and maybe making less than where they were making in another district, but for many factors decide to come here. So that is not the case. We try to balance things as best we can with getting the most highly qualified person possible for the job.
I wouldn't say that, because the person that you're referring to, who's now retired and doesn't work here any longer, has been working as an administrator or a teacher in education in New York State for over 30 years before she retired. And the two positions below that, the other person that was on there has also retired, and that position has been vacated. So if what you can't compare the university and what you're paying to a public school district. I could give you that same position in Nassau County, and that position would be making probably $250,000, depending on the district. So it all is dependent upon where you're working and what, as Cheryl indicated, the collective bargaining of that unit. So as you're hearing, the individual that replaced, actually the position was split and two different people were put into two different positions, taking over components of it. One person was promoted from within after research, and another person was promoted after research as well, took on aspects of that job when it was created. And obviously neither one of them were making close to that salary. Depending on your opinion of that district.
Okay. And so that's really the comparison you're looking at. What do we get that, well below what everybody else is paying? We get someone good for that.
Right. And the thing I would contend back with you is then if you're going to pay, you have to work with a bargaining unit to work on what the salary is going to be based upon what. Yes, and that's a union. You have to work within the union structure and what the salaries are. Teacher union, administrator union, we have 11 units here?
We have 11.
So you have to work within that structure, which is not something probably you may be used to at that level of administration. I don't know if there's an administrative unit at the university for that particular
role. I don't know if we would want our basis of recruiting to be, who can we? Let's find the cheapest person we can find to do the job.
And
I don't think
at the cheapest rate.
but right. And a lot of people who are applying for these higher level positions also are people who have many, many years of experience in education. So we are looking for somebody who has a lot of experience to be able to step into these positions. So
you're going through that process now with a replacement for Mr. Scanlon, right? So you're going through that now at this time. Question, Mr. Dabrowski. Under you listed on the table, the organization chart,
yes.
You're a listed assistant superintendent for human resources, correct? Yes. And then under there is executive director of human resources and secondary curriculum. What role does this administrator play in your world? And there's nobody under this person, so what is that position all about?
That position is one that, as we heard earlier, we have 11 units and probably 2,500 active employees in terms of permanent and sub-teachers. You can imagine that there are several things that we deal with on a daily basis, mm-hmm. in terms of discrimination, harassment, interviewing, advertising, gathering data. So that mm-hmm. person is an assistant of mine.
Okay.
Called me wherever we kind of designate the need at the time. And it's usually which fire that we look to put out first. So,
okay.
In terms of responsibility, I can't speak to his curriculum responsibilities because he's shared between Kevin's office and my office. I will share in terms of the human resource piece. We are divide and conquer. We're a big place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It requires a lot of supervision from time to time. So he is my assistant.
Okay, I see him here as well.
Right.
I would say probably between 2,000, 2,500. I'm talking with subs. I'm talking with. I'm not talking permanent employees. I'm just talking in general, the scheme of things.
Yeah. General. An average payday, we issue about 1,500 paychecks. Because that 2,000 might include people who are on our rolls as subs, but maybe haven't worked in a couple of months.
Right.
But still considered active.
These are people that kind of come and go, as Jeff is saying. So, and that's what I was going to talk to you after this about the numbers that you're looking for. It's a snapshot in time versus what the whole year looks like. So when we did an analysis, we hire probably 100 people a month. It doesn't mean those 100 people aren't necessarily working, you know what I mean? But we have the subs ready, or we have the permanent position that's ready. It's a living, breathing organism in terms of we're going to keep bringing the bodies in. We're not necessarily paying them at that period of time.
Right.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
He, also, the individual who's in that role has a Juris Doctorate. He has a great deal of experience. He does our superintendent's hearings, which we no longer outsource. He also reviews all of our policies because of his legal background. He looks at all the custodial reports that come in terms of custody issues. So he serves a multifaceted purpose for us. Also, any of the Dignity for All Students Act investigations that occur with regard to staff are done by him. So.
He also does, in addition to that, the residency hearings for us when we have residents that come into question if they really live in the district and are sending their children here or not,
mm-hmm.
which under his piece of doing that, we've actually caught, sadly, several people that have done that and have mm-hmm. been removed from the district. Under the curriculum end of it, the secondary curriculum, we have hundreds, and I mean hundreds of courses that potentially we have on the books. The board has a policy that we're supposed to be reviewing those courses every 5 years to make sure that they're up to the standards and that the curriculum is updated. So that is a massive undertaking. The Curriculum Development Committee is part of that process. You'll see this coming spring when we start writing curriculum projects. Secondary projects get reviewed by Dr. Baum. Elementary projects get reviewed by Dr. Rinaldi in her role as Director of Elementary Curriculum. So those all funnel through. But it's a massive undertaking. The spreadsheet for that alone probably equals Jeff's budgetary charts when you look at it.
But I'm sorry. I actually, I had 100 in my head. It was 100 people since September. Not 100 people a month. I'd never be home. But 100 people since September. So we roughly hire about 20 people a month.
And then just lately, in lately, over the last even 10 years, there's just been so much more of whether it be investigations that have to be done, not just us, everywhere, all schools. Investigations have to be done, reports have to be filed. This is more and more and more and more and more. It's not a sob story, I'm not getting that. But like one of the things, Alan, if you remember back, going back to last summer, all the commercials from the attorneys that said if you were abused by a scout leader or a wealthy businessman, when you know the statute of limitations was opened up on those suits. We got claims. You might think I'm trying to sound funny when I say it this way, but I am not even kidding. We would get, well, in 1965, I was at Jelinas Junior High School, and a gym teacher looked at me funny, and it made me uncomfortable, and it's ruined my life ever since, and now I'm suing. And we have to spend hours and hours and hours and researching and digging through archives to find what we can. Because if we can't make – we had to hire an insurance archaeologist. I mean, I never knew there was such a thing. But, you know, all of that kind of stuff, and it just takes so much time and time and time to read. Because we can't just say, you know, then we lose the case. We don't want to do that. So,
a couple other quick questions that I have. In terms of the organizational chart, will we be seeing any additions or changes for the next year?
I think you were recommending we add a few administrative positions.
Oh yeah, right? Absolutely.
Fewer superintendents, maybe.
Absolutely.
You may see some
Starbucks goer.
I would say you may see some restructuring. You would not see us adding any administrative positions, but possibly restructuring within some of the departments.
Restructuring, okay. And just to help me understand this, all of those positions, administrative positions, they are under contract. Is that correct or not?
The four of us plus Alan Baum
are
not in any union. Right, so the superintendent has a
union. Have a contract.
Well, we each have.
Everybody has a contract.
So in your contract, say in Mr. Scanlon's new contract, is it outlined that over the next, say, how long is the contract for?
3 years.
3 years. Is it said that over this year he'll receive this much of a raise, this much of a raise?
Yeah.
No, that's
no.
not done.
Okay. Just the initial.
Okay, great.
Well, of all the other administrators that are listed on that one chart we've given, the principals, directors, executive directors, they're all members of the Three Village School Administrators Association.
Okay.
Including chairs.
Okay.
Right.
The chair people are members of that unit.
So just to answer your question, with some superintendents' contracts, not here, they do build in a increase every year.
Okay.
But that has never been the case, at least this is my 10th year, has not been the case. In
okay.
Oh, and something that's also fairly common, too, with that is a school superintendent's contract can't be less than 3 years, and it can't be more than 5 years, right? So what some districts do, and some superintendents have it written in their contract, is each year, as another year ends, a year gets tacked on at the end. It can never go out more than 5 years, but some have it that extra year tacked on automatically so it's always 5 years more.
They can increase it by year by year.
But it can never go out more than 5 years at a time. So what some superintendents have is, so if I'm the superintendent, I'm finishing up my first year, right? I have 4 more years on my contract. Now the board, I automatically get added a year at the end. So now I have 5 more years. And then at the end of that year, now I have still five more years. And the problem with that, and it's great for the superintendent, but the problem with that is if the board ever decides, you know what, we don't really want to renew the superintendent's contract, they're on the hook for 5 more years. And you either have to just wait it out, or you have to buy the person out, and that's a problem, and that happens a lot.
Jeff, I have one more quick question too.
Yes, sir.
Why aren't we using NYSHIP? Are we sure that we're saving money?
We belong, and we've belonged to a self-insured health insurance consortium since 1991. it more or less mirrors NYSHIP as far as the benefits go, very close. Our rates are very close. There are some years when our rates are a little higher, some rates when our rates are lower. Right now, they're lower. Over time, it pretty much evens out. And, you know, one of the things that I thought, in fact, when I first started here, was, well, wait a second. But everybody that belongs to NYSHIP, like every participant.
Almost everyone.
No, I mean, but everybody who does, right? Every participating employer who belongs to NYSHIP pays the same rate, whether you're in Suffolk County, you're in Nassau County, you could be in Watertown, right? Everybody in the state who belong, every participating agency pays the same rate. So my thinking at first was, hello, Mr. Cornreich. My thinking at first was, well, wait a second. If all our costs are concentrated on Long Island, one of the most expensive parts of the state, maybe that works against us because NYSHIP, the costs are kind of spread throughout the state. Well, if you were to look and just take, because some of the different types of agencies pay different, you know, I'm not sure exactly how the university does, but school districts, for instance. So I looked at the school districts in New York State that belong to NYSHIP. Outside of Nassau, Suffolk, Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, Orange, and the Capital Region, there is not a single school district in the state that belongs to NYSHIP because their costs, if you're in Utica and you go to a neurologist, you might pay a $50 office visit. Here it costs, I don't know what it costs, but it costs a lot more. So the vast majority of NYSHIP, at least as far as school districts go, NYSHIP members are Nassau, Suffolk, Westchester, Rockland. So they're also, most of their costs are concentrated in the most expensive area in the state. So it actually kind of makes sense that there wouldn't be a big cost difference. So right now our rates are lower than NYSHIP's. As I said, there have been years when our rates are higher. So it does vary. Now,
so
one of the
do you feel like you're taking a risk doing that?
I don't think so. It's worked well for us for over 30 years now. And one of the things I will say I do like about it is because we're small, right? So there's three districts involved, right? So that's Smithtown and South Country. And each district has two seats on the Board of Trustees, right? So the each district has a management rep and an employee rep, right? The teachers union elects the employee rep that sits on the board, and the Board of Education appoints the management rep. So I'm the management rep on the Board of Trustees for the Suffolk Schools Employees Health Plan. So what I like about it is we can make changes, right? We could say, hey, let's put in whatever kind of program. Well, and the administrator of the plan is United Healthcare, which is the biggest healthcare administrator in the country, who also administers NYSHIP. So it's basically the same network as NYSHIP. It's the same pricing structure because it's all United Healthcare anyway. But we can make changes. We could say, hey, let's put in this program that might save a lot of money. You know, maybe by getting prescription drugs from Canada, for instance. I don't know if we can do that now, but when we could, let's put something like that in place. If it saves us money, we can continue it. If it doesn't save money, we'll get rid of it. We can make decisions like that and make changes quickly. Whereas NYSHIP,
So in principle, we could shift over to NYSHIP at any point. Is that right,
or
is
there the way our teachers' contract is, it's in the contract that they would have to agree to it.
That would have to be negotiated in a teachers' contract.
Yes.
Yeah.
So and if there were some years ago, maybe I don't remember now, 10 or 12 years ago, our costs were higher, mm-hmm. and we had. And we just laid it out with our teachers' union and said, unless something changes, we think we're going to need to switch. And they were okay with it because they're not going to lose on the benefits. And there's nothing that the teachers get out of it. And if it costs, because everybody here pays a portion of health insurance, right? So the more health insurance, the more the insurance costs the district, the more it costs each individual employee also, because we all pay a percentage of it in. So
I think we pay an unusually high level. The district pays an unusually high level of the health care
for teachers. No, I don't know. I think our attorney, who said like in, I don't know, 40 districts or something, said the, because this question just came up recently. Right. I think the average is anywhere for like for 15 to 20%, and our teachers are at 18.
They will be.
Well, they're at 17 now. They're going up to 18.
He said that we are kind of in the middle.
They pay 18%.
Yeah. Well, right now 17 in this contract, it goes up to 18.
So I have one question to tack on to that, right? So it certainly, typically it is more cost effective, right, being self-funded versus using other insurance, right, because they have so much overhead. But is it ever shopped around, right? Because it's self-funded, but UnitedHealthcare administers it, which that's very similar to other self-funded health insurance that I've seen. Is that the company who is to administer it, is that ever shopped around?
It used to be Vitra, and then it switched over to UnitedHealthcare, and that's been for quite a while. I think we've been satisfied with them. We have looked at over the years occasionally, and we'll say, hey, let's see what else is out there.
So but the last time it was that like every 3 years or something?
Probably. I don't remember say exactly, but yeah, every few years we have that discussion of, hey, let's see what else is out there. If somebody wants to make a proposal and see if they could do it better for cheaper. As I said, last time we switched, though, was from Vitra to UnitedHealthcare, and that was, I think that was in 2007.
That's probably, might be due to be looked at, right? Because, there could be other competitive
options.
But if you were to do that, though, you would need the coverage by the teachers union contract and the other kind. The coverage would not be able to change. They wouldn't be able to get less coverage.
Well, right. What's in their contract, and part of the original agreement going back to 1991 to switch from NYSHIP to look at something else was the benefits have to be substantially similar to what NYSHIP is. So that's still in the contract. So the teachers union would have no say or whether we, as SSEHP, look to change administrators. That doesn't need.
I wouldn't want benefits to go down for any of them. But it's just who's administering and managing it.
So the teachers, if you wanted to make a change to a different carrier, would that be negotiated in the teachers' contract?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because that's just who's handling the paperwork, basically.
Right.
As long as the benefits didn't change.
Yep.
Right.
same way.
Now, switch from SSCHP to say, we don't want to do that anymore, we're going to go back to NYSHIP, that we have to work
at. Right, because that's a different plan already at that point, different benefits.
Right.
Yeah. Jeff, I've got one more question, sorry. If you were us and you were looking for things to cut, to reduce costs so that we could get a 0% increase or even a decrease, what would you cut?
0%. You got a 0% increase this year.
We're looking for another one.
What would I cut? I think the first thing to cut would be what we were talking about before, looking at those electives at the secondary level to see, not cut electives, but if we can condense some of those and cut some teaching positions. When I'm talking about, cutting teacher positions, I'm not trying to pick on teachers, and I'm not saying just that. If we're cutting teaching positions, we know that also means there has to be some administrative cuts and some clerical and some custodians, and we know that. But the big dollars are in teachers' salaries, and benefits. So if we're talking about saving big money, it means number of teachers. But that would be one thing I look at. Something that maybe the community might want to, brought up before about maybe closing a building. Well, that might be something that the community wants to put a big committee together to look at you know, where does the district want to go as like a strategic planning thing in the next 3, 5, 10 years? Do we want to consider reconfiguring elementary schools? You know, some districts do have primary schools and intermediate schools. Maybe we could do something like that. Maybe people say, no, I like the K to six setup. Maybe ninth grade goes to the high school. Maybe people say, oh no, my baby can't go to the high school.
Yeah,
I want my baby in junior high.
Very happy when I have to be here.
So, yeah. but all those things are things that, you know, maybe people want to look at.
I've been here a very long time.
And you know, it's awful making those changes. The process of making changes like that is awful. That doesn't mean, you know, after it's in place, it can't work. But those are the kind of things. You know, hey, you want to go real crazy? Okay. Well, in a few years, we could move. Right? I'm not saying we should do this. But we could move. We could move. And Romans, another couple of years, we could do this. We could move ninth grade to the high school, right? Keep K to six elementary schools. Make junior high school seventh and eighth grade. Then you know what? We only need one of them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So... could we do that? Sure. But which one do we close? And the other half of the town is going to go ballistic.
Like crazy you wouldn't believe.
Crazy like you wouldn't believe.
You can't even get everybody at Nassau Peg in one building with everybody freezing.
If you tied it to a tax cut, maybe you could sell it, though.
No.
I don't think so.
Never going to sell
it? That would save us a lot of money.
It would save a lot of money. There's a lot of things that would save us a lot of money.
That would save. Would there be a big savings if we could, going down the road, putting ninth grade at the high school? Like, would that save us?
I don't know about the cost savings with teachers, but from a programmatic standpoint, having the ninth grade at the high school would be helpful from a programmatic standpoint, secondary curriculum being what it is, ninth grade in most other school districts as at the high school level. And, you know, there are some, as Cheryl said, there's some in this community that like our configuration. We're one of only about a half a dozen schools left in the district.
I am not one of those people. But
I understand. I was a teacher here started back in 1996 after being in Connecticut and New York City for a number of years. That was talked about even back then. Cheryl could probably tell you it was back in the 80s that it was even discussed.
About putting our ninth grade in.
Yes, that was... That,
so these kind of changes, I know, are the kind of changes that would take a long time to do and would have to have... I mean, you have to have
a strategic vision, and you have to have community input from a lot of sources. And a move like that wouldn't just be done overnight in 1 year.
Yeah.
It would take a long time.
Here's the other thing you have to consider. There are many changes that have happened to Ward Melville High School over the years. So I was at Ward Melville High School in 1984. There were probably close to 2,500, 2,200 students at Ward Melville. It was an open campus, and at that time, 18 credits were required for students in order to graduate. So things were very different. Things were structured differently. And at that point, it's still a 10 through 12 building. Right now, if you consider that the high school is close to 1,500 students with 10 through 12, you're going to add another 500 some odd students to Ward Melville High School. You now have more requirements for the students, 22, right, credits.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a closed campus. So you have to take all of those things into consideration. What are you going to do with those students? How are you going to fit all of those students in that? It is a very large building, I give you that. And it's grown since we added the two additions to Ward Melville High School over the years since I've been here. However, all of that needs to be taken into consideration in making that decision. And there are parents who feel that ninth grade students should not be mixed in. There are high schools that keep their ninth graders as a freshman campus separate and apart from their older students. So all of those factors need to be given very, very careful consideration. Have we, you know... If you look at it, we may be considered the dinosaur of keeping a junior high school structure in place. Has it in any way negatively impacted the academic success of our students? I'd have to say absolutely not. Absolutely not. So all of that is going to be something the community really, really needs to delve into. And I will tell you that when Frank Carosetti was here, there was a large committee. I had served on it at that time that did look at moving ninth grade to Ward Melville High School and did look at a middle school program of 6, 7, 8. It was at that time, and things changed, so we have to be respectful of that. It was resoundingly defeated by the community. They had absolutely no interest in pursuing that. And I know there have been studies done about departmentalization, and so you would have to look at all of that before making a very informed decision.
Just longer,
back
yeah, longer than
yeah.
That.
I mean, so I think it's good discussions to be having. I don't think you ever agree to that, but it's still going to be updated numbers and updated information on that. So
I think the two community might agree to it nowadays. I mean, I don't think educationally they've suffered. I don't believe that at all. I think it's been perfectly fine educationally, the way not having ninth grade there. Social emotionally, though, being able to only having those 3 years in high school for kids, especially kids that have been split in SK, I mean my three kids, but a lot of kids, not just my own, but finding their footing all the way through has been so difficult for so many as they go through, because you spend all of 10th grade trying to find your people and trying to figure out what you're going to do. You don't have the access to clubs you had when you would have had in ninth grade, where you can kind of feel you can't even be in honor society until a year later because you're not if you're in a senior high school. Like these little pieces here about the experience, which I could speak to as a parent of kids that have been through it. Not you all know that, but the community, once you go through it, I love the idea when my kids are in elementary school, they were going to be there 3 years. Now that I've done it 3 times, I see all the benefits that would have been missed by that. My daughter could not bear being in junior high, and when all of her friends went to high school and it was over, we had one more year of torture before she got to go to high school and it was over. You know, so as speaking as a parent of that, I would advocate that tremendously, but I know the landscape, and it's not easy to do. I guess as far as budgeting wise, something like that, is there a big savings in the community? The community that's not happy with the sizes, would there be a big savings in consolidating this or closing elementary schools, which is another whole wall of wax people hate?
Mm-hmm. I think when you close an elementary school, you definitely have initial savings, without a doubt. I mean, that's indisputable, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're consolidating classes. You might not need as many teachers. The savings on the building itself. The problem comes in is if your enrollment changes, and we've watched our enrollment in Three Village go like a roller coaster, mm-hmm. right? Try reopening that building and what the cost would be involved with that. So those are things that you really need to look at very carefully in terms of your demographics. And again, we're kind of in a weird position right now, mm-hmm. because we're seeing the enrollment go up, and I know Dr. McKinnon, you talked about that, but sometimes I think anecdotal data is so important, and having worked with the district registrar in our district, many different registrars, that information is really important, because what we're hearing is that there are a lot of people moving into the district right now, and many of them have children who are not yet school age. So those children, our future children in Three Village, we don't know who they are because we don't have that information. All we have is our preschoolers that have registered for our program. So the 3 and 2 year olds that will be coming up in years, that's such important information for the district to have as they start to plan.
Just want to go on the record that in 1984, Gary and I were in eighth grade. Just saying. But Cheryl is exactly right.
Well, and even with today's current enrollment, right, if we were closed in elementary school, then that would increase class sizes in the 4 remaining, right?
No. That would not increase class sizes.
Not necessarily.
Are there enough empty classrooms?
Okay. There are empty classrooms.
Okay,
in certain buildings. In certain buildings, there are not. So if you take Setauket, there are very few empty classrooms. Arrowhead basically has no empty classrooms. Nassiqueg, which at one point housed close to 1,000 students, has definitely empty classrooms. Mount has some empty classrooms for sure. Minnesaukee, not really. Minnesaukee is actually our largest elementary school right now in terms of enrollment.
Okay.
So over
That's where my kid is, so that's why I figured that there was the free space.
Right, yes.
But Nassau Keag was redistricted years ago.
Nassau Keag and Arrowhead were big time redistricted.
Yes.
But because Arrowhead also houses a lot of our self-contained program there, and the amount of room that we need, there really is no room at Arrowhead. I mean, I know Marissa is always struggling to find space.
Is there a regular interval when the elementary schools are redistricted?
Not necessarily.
No.
Because everybody Yes.
I can imagine, right? Because everybody gets very territorial.
Ian, maybe next year when I'm not here.
Yeah. Another one for you, Kevin.
I'll be outside Cheryl's house yelling.
All right. So you're going to let me know if there's budget codes that you want some specifics on, whether it be what was that code, what was in that, why did this go up so much, why did that go down so much, that kind of stuff. Yeah, whatever you want, and we'll get any request that you have, we'll get it turned around as quickly as possible and back out to you. But, yeah, I mean, keep the questions coming. You know, we want to get you. Their budget requests are due in to my office on Friday. Yes. Yes. Yeah, well, that's kind of like, well, first thing I do is I take what they said, because like, so for instance, for this coming up year, for any individual, if you're a principal and you had whatever, these budget codes, right, whatever they added up to in the current year, that's what you have for next year for those same budget codes. No increase, right? There have been years where we say you can go up 2% or whatever, but for this coming up year, it was no increase. So we'll take those, right? And we'll put those into the budget, right? So once, and as I had said to you, there is no part of the budget that's complete until the whole thing is complete. Because after it's all in there, and then we go through, you'll go through. And, you know, and I always tell principals, you know, your budget, so when we get to July, right, and your budget isn't necessarily what you asked for. It's this, what I'm giving you now, what the board approved and then the community voted on, that's your budget, not what you originally asked for. So, I'll take those numbers and we'll put them into the budget, and that's all part of, well, we'll see where we're at and then what we have to do with that. And I do, you know, when I go through and if I see the last few years and some codes that they're not spending the money, I try not to take it away from the principals, because sometimes it might be that, well, I would like to still have the money in my budget in case I need it. I haven't needed it in the last couple of years, especially if we're not talking, I'm not talking something that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm talking if they have $1,200 in a supply code. If they don't need it, you know, I'm hesitant to just take it away because they haven't spent it, because I like them to know that they don't need to spend all their money. And I'd rather them be comfortable knowing that they don't have to spend all of their money in their budget because they're going to lose it the following year. That doesn't mean it can never happen either, though. But so.
I think at this point that we are probably holding off on STEM. We had spoke with the elementary principals, and their feeling was very strong that they did not want a fragmented program, that if we were going to add the program gradually, which is what we spoke about, because we knew that adding STEM back would be $500,000. And their feeling was that if you're going to give us two people and spread it out among five schools, that is just going to create more havoc for us than anything. And we would rather that you just hold off, keep class size small, focus on other issues rather than focusing specifically on that. And at other conversations that we've had, some of the elementary teachers have brought up other ideas that I think Kevin and the new assistant superintendent will want to explore as ways that we can use existing staff
to bring those programs to fruition that may make more sense for the district moving forward. So I think that is being explored. In terms of secondary, there really has been a large push at the from junior high school parents in particular to bring back some of the writing center that they felt was really beneficial, and also the math center that was really helpful to the kids. So we're looking at existing staff to see if that is possible to do that, because we did see a great benefit for the students in terms of that. And again, just keeping elementary class size where it is, and we shared that information with you. Do I think those numbers are relatively optimal? I do. But I think we all feel strongly that, especially at the elementary level, we need to keep those classes at that size.
Quick question. The STEM teachers, I think you said that they were repurposed during COVID. Are those the four technology coaches?
Two of them are. We always had two technology leads, but the other two were repurposed, and the others were placed back into the classroom. So they serve in the classroom.
Is it normal for other districts to have technology coaches that are technically teachers? I mean, isn't that more of a support staff position?
I think it would depend from district to district. We haven't really explored what other districts are doing, but we've, for as long as I can remember, we've had two of them. We added the other two when COVID happened, and we were, and every student was issued a Chromebook. And many of our teachers, particularly at the elementary level, weren't as, I'm going to say, as astute in terms of all of the electronics and the technology. And that kind of support has been critical for them. Now they're using the technology at a greater rate, and that support is being provided to them through those technology coaches.
We basically had to retrain our entire staff. You know, we received a lot of criticism, mostly Cheryl and I, in March of 2020, because we weren't moving fast enough to...
Mostly for elementary.
Elementary at that time. We basically had to take our, as Jeff said, our most senior teachers who have not been in a college setting, you know, going for a degree, on technology that they didn't have. You know, we didn't have one-to-one devices in the elementary level prior to COVID. It was a secondary initiative at that point in time. So it took a lot to do that. And that support, while still present, is continuing. Does that mean it can wane off at some point? Perhaps, if COVID starts to diminish. But if tomorrow we have another uptick or we're all remote, we're going to need those individuals to help support those
right.
teachers.
But I also think that our elementary teachers now have really been engaged with the technology. They're very interested. They're using it in very productive ways. And they're looking for more training and more support to be able to do that. Not to say that that's taking the place of other things that go in the classroom, but we look at technology as an integration, not as a separate unit.
Yeah, and I'll add, as an elementary parent, right, yeah, spring of 2020 was certainly very challenging for all of us for a number of reasons, but I would just like to say how the remote program from spring of 2020 to then what then became 20 to 21 was immeasurably better. I mean, it was incredible, actually, how well that system worked. And, you know, I experienced it firsthand, and it was definitely very impressive on how well it was, and was a good experience for my family as well as the majority of other families I know that did the remote program. So that was...
I also believe that it was a contributing factor to why many families moved into this district, comparing what other districts did or did not do. We received 150 new students from New York City alone last year because of what we were able to do. Just this morning, I was on the phone with a parent who just bought a house from New York City here and is moving in next year because of what our reputation was, what we did prior to COVID and during COVID and going forward.
Yep.
Many of our students didn't lose a beat going through the system.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean that we're not contending with COVID-related issues, social-emotional issues, and academic issues as we move forward, but we're better able to address that than many students. Some neighboring districts, they were hand-delivering packets to bus stops all of last year. So we didn't do that.
No.
So, oh, just by the way, this, as Cheryl alluded to, The elementary science curriculum has now changed into a stream curriculum. So that the standards have switched over. That's why Cheryl's mentioning that when we're talking about STEM as a standalone, the science standards in New York State are now a stream standards. They're not stream. The R is research and the A is arts is added to that STEM acronym that's been used. Yeah, and we'll keep going. When I retire, it's going to be.
We have to get social studies into that too somehow.
Yeah. And physics. We'll just call it school.
All right. Anything else for tonight? All right. Thanks, everybody.